Hello and welcome to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and in the third and for now the last episode in our little mini-series about how Brexit is being taken up in academia, we brought on Robert Lawson, who is a lecturer and course director at Birmingham City University's School of English and responsible for the linguistics arm of the Centre for Brexit Studies. We cover a whole range of ground in this interview, from how language was used during the Brexit campaign to form distinct delineations of belonging, to the future of language learning in post-Brexit Britain and the benefits of being bilingual. So if you're a linguistics and semiotics nerd like I am, you'll really enjoy this one. And if you want to hear more from people involved in the Centre for Brexit Studies, I recommend you listen back to episode 48 with Alex DeRuyter and 46 with Dr. Martin Glynn. To get those episodes, as well as all upcoming ones sent straight to your phone, you can subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast, or you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast.
Hi, Robert. Welcome to the podcast.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
For our last episode, we had on Alex DeRuyter, who's heading up BCU's Centre for Brexit Studies, and you're involved with that as well, as far as I understand. So I'm quite curious how you're involved in that, in what capacity?
So the Centre for Brexit Studies was set up a few months ago, looking at essentially the effect of Brexit on the UK. And what we had done was to set up a number of different kinds of strands, effectively looking at everything from the economy to national identity, creative practice, and so on. And one of the streams of the centre was on language. So I'm a researcher in language and linguistics at Birmingham City University, and thought that it would be useful for us to have a language strand looking at all sorts of different kinds of things, I suppose, looking at everything from how people talked about Brexit in different kinds of places, whether that was online in places like Twitter, whether it was in print newspapers, whether it was in the national news, on TV programmes and so on. So what we wanted to do was to set up a language stream for us to investigate the role of language in the Brexit debate, effectively.
I've read a couple of things that you have written about this topic in regards to Brexit online. Mm-hmm. And you mention how language can sort of function as a tool through which we then form our sense of national identity. Can you explain how you see that process working and how that manifested itself in the referendum campaign and since then?
So when we talk, we instantly tell people lots about who we are, where we're from, whether we are male or female, what age we are, whether we are young, old, middle-aged, potentially what class we are, whether we're working class, middle class, or upper class, or however you want to define class. And when we talk, we're given off an awful lot of information about ourselves. And because language is so tied to our sense of self, our identity, then it's only obvious, it's only natural, I suppose, that kind of following the Brexit decision, that the language became a really important focal point, especially on the link between sort of language, I guess, and national identity, community, and belonging. So this idea of, you know, who can claim legitimate British identity, and who can't, and how far is language a part of how people make those kinds of decisions and evaluations. So that's really, I think, where the kind of main role of language the main role of language plays in the Brexit debate, I guess. And then there's also the kind of how do people talk about Brexit? Do they talk about it in, you know, positive terms, negative terms? If they do, then what kind of vocabulary do they use? How are these kinds of discussions and debates framed? So there's an awful lot of kind of really interesting linguistic material going on following Brexit.
Robert, it's Tim here. Is language being ever more scrutinised in terms of how we get over the messaging? I'm thinking particularly of a presidential speech, for example, or a speech from the Prime Minister, where every word is now pored over and dissected and regurgitated.
Mm-hmm.
Is that grown over the piece?
I mean, I think probably it has. I mean, I think first and foremost, the growth of social media over the course of the last 10 years has given, you know, an awful lot more platforms for people to talk about, to talk about language, to talk about how people are using language, the kinds of vocabulary that people are using, the kinds of linguistic strategies that people are using, and especially how that's being used in the kind of public forums, politics, government policy, and so on. So I would say, yeah, certainly in the last sort of 12 months, we've seen a big uptick on how people are engaging with linguistics and how people are starting to think more critically, I suppose, about how people are using language. And I think Trump, for example, and his linguistic practices, I think have been under the spotlight by linguists and non-linguists alike in a way that many former presidents really haven't had that kind of attention in the UK context, thinking about how people are talking about Brexit and again the role of language in a kind of post-Brexit world, language learning and teaching, especially, you know, what's going to be the role of English in a post-Brexit Europe? What are we going to do about learning modern languages in Europe? Will there be more of a drive towards encouraging high school pupils, university students to learn these kinds of European languages? Or will we gradually become, you know, even more insular in the UK and focus primarily on English at the detriment of learning other languages? So certainly for someone like myself who's really interested in language, who spends a lot of his working day thinking about and researching language, this is, you know, it's a really exciting time for us just now, because there's loads and loads and loads of really, really interesting things that we can look at, and it's great to see so many people, you know, kind of interested in some of the ideas that the linguists are exploring.
I'm particularly interested in something you mentioned earlier about language being able to sort of connotate an us and a them, so sort of a separation between being British and not being British. So
yeah.
You see that obviously a lot in media coverage, but also I feel like in official language, so things like calling immigrants without a visa illegal aliens and things like that, the kind of terminology used there. Can you give us a couple more specific examples of how you saw that playing out with Brexit?
So the illegal immigrants, illegal aliens one was certainly one of the kind of big ones, both in the UK and actually in the US as well. The Linguistic Society of America put out a position paper basically calling on journalists to avoid, you know, really effectively loaded terminology and the way that it kind of marginalizes, stigmatizes these communities. So there's certainly something to be said about the power that words have. In terms of Brexit, I'm just trying to think now of other examples that might have been seen in the media. The illegal aliens was one. I suppose, you know, the kind of the hordes, the horde of rats, you know, horde of vermin, kind of imagery that was used in the post-Brexit and the pre-Brexit discussion as well. So there was the infamous take back our NHS, the £350 million figure that would be diverted back to the NHS, and on that poster there was a whole bunch of people, and I think that kind of imagery of a kind of invading horde was used quite heavily during the Brexit debate, you know, the run up to the actual decision itself. So, you know, I think what we saw was an awful lot of kind of othering, depersonalization, dehumanizing of migrant communities, asylum seekers, that effectively kind of pushed them out to the margins of society, and effectively made them other, made them somehow less than human. And I think that those kinds of strategies are really dangerous in terms of kind of our commitment to social justice, I suppose. So yeah, those would be some of the kind of examples I would say that came out quite strongly during the kind of the run up to the Brexit decision.
Do you think those are deliberate strategies?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I think that it depends on the ideological angle of the journalist writing them, of the newspaper carrying them, of the side claiming them. All language is ideological, and certainly the linguistic strategies that we use are deliberate, and so they certainly would have been considered. They may not necessarily have thought through the ramifications of what those terms might connotate, what they might mean, kind of beyond the kind of superficial meaning of it. But yeah, they would have certainly been intended. But whether these, speechwriters, campaign managers and so on would have really thought through what the connotations of their choices meant is certainly up for debate.
I'm curious to what extent you think language shapes and influences our experience and our opinions. How do you see it being as inevitably effective, sort of if people read it, then they will believe it, or how do you see that working?
Well, there's been an awful lot of research on this in terms of the persuasive capacity of language. How can we use language to persuade people, to motivate people? And we know that language has an awful lot of power in terms of shaping people's worldviews and informing their opinions. So there's certainly, a massive role of the media in reporting particular events in certain ways that might shape how those events are perceived, and how those events are evaluated by readers, by listeners, by people, watching the news, reading an article on the BBC website or other websites. So yeah, we know that language has a really effective power of changing people's minds, of influencing their opinion.
So in terms of how it's been since the referendum campaign, obviously we just talked about how divisive it was during the campaign. Do you think that Theresa May and her government have been good at striking a more conciliatory, sort of unified tone rather than trying to separate things into sides and things like that?
I think that there has been, a very fine line to be walked here. I think things like the decision not to guarantee the rights of EU citizens that was just recently defeated in the House of Lords, for example, is probably more towards the antagonistic side than it is towards the conciliatory side of things. It's a difficult line to walk. Whether Theresa May has been successful in that, I think, is an open question, depending on whether you're European and living in the UK, or whether you're British and voted for Leave or Remain. I don't think that there's a definitive answer to say whether she's done well on being conciliatory or divisive. I think that she's tried to deal with what has been a very difficult decision for people on both sides to kind of negotiate their way through. But certainly I think more could be done to deal with how far people with European languages might feel welcome and integrated in the UK. So there was an article in The Guardian last September, where a bunch of, you know, a whole bunch of European citizens who held maybe dual citizenship of a European country and Britain were basically worried about speaking their native language in public because they were concerned that that would draw attention to them, that it would potentially lead to them being attacked, that they would maybe face, you know, kind of violent reactions from people. And I find that that kind of concern by European speakers is really, you know, is really worrisome. So I think, you know, that Theresa May could do more to assure European and, you know, European communities, European people about the rights to remain in the UK.
Robert, in your research, have you looked at the impact of, I suppose, increasing brevity in the use of language and also repetition, the idea that we have a short, simple message and we're just going to hammer it home at every opportunity, and whether that is effective on the public?
Yeah, I mean, again, there has been research that's looked at this. I think short, snappy catchphrases that are easily remembered, that can be, you know, quite easily repeated, resonate with a lot of people, especially if they're catchy. Trump, I think, was a really great example of this. You know, the Make America Great Again campaign. You know, that was a really short, punchy, and sort of captivating slogan, and that certainly won an awful lot of people around. So yeah, the more that we, you know, the more that the campaigns use those kinds of strategies, and they're also, you know, really easy to transmit, you know, whether that's via social media, whether that's in advertising boards, whether it's in newspapers, whether it's on TV and leaflets and so on. So the more that, you know, quite complex issues can be reduced to relatively straightforward catchphrases that omit a lot of the detail and a lot of the important detail, that's certainly a strategy that campaigns will use, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, just sticking with Trump for a minute, when he talks about threats to America, he sort of generally just talks about bad people.
Mm.
Is there a danger in this kind of dumbing down of language?
In my opinion, yeah, absolutely. The more that we simplify a message, the more that we simplify an issue, the more we move away from actually dealing with the intricacies and the complexities of a particular issue, and then it becomes very, very much, you know, as you say, in the case of Trump, reducing things down into good or bad, us versus them. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, which was one that George W. Bush used in the post 9/11 attack. So yeah, when we start to reduce those kinds of messages down into kind of quite pithy one-liners, then we run the risk of effectively negating the kind of public the complexity of these issues. And I think that, you know, the general public deserve to have the full fact and to not have these campaigns reduced into, you know, effectively kind of binary oppositions. And that was, again, something that we saw an awful lot during the Brexit debate. It was, you know, the UK versus the EU. It was migrants versus legal citizens. It was us versus them. It was scroungers versus taxpayers. And these kinds of strategies are really divisive. But certainly from my perspective, if we're going to dumb down language, as you know, like you say, then I think that's a real worry.
Mm. So if we're looking at the language landscape in the EU, of course, at the moment, English is sort of the official language of a lot of academics and politics and economics within Europe. Do you think that actually stands to change because of Brexit, or do you think it's been so established now that that's pretty untouchable?
Yeah, well, I mean, so France said that English would stop being an official language not long after the Brexit decision was announced. Whether that will actually carry on through is an open question. Honestly, we really are in kind of no man's land in a lot of ways as far as the role of English goes in the EU. Yeah, it has a massive cultural and political monopoly at the moment. It's the language of global commerce, of the internet, of international politics. It has a, you know, massive cultural prestige, but whether that will carry on or not is really an open question. My take on it is that at least for the next sort of 20, 30 years, English will maintain that position. But beyond that, it's really hard to say whether another European language will take over, and maybe English will start being pushed out to the sidelines. It's really, really difficult to say. We really are, like I say, in kind of no man's land. Where we go from here over the course of the next 30 years is an open question. But it will be interesting to see what happens. And then there's the other side of it as well, what will happen with European languages in the UK. At the moment, the UK lags behind pretty much every other major nation or in terms of language learning and the percentage of high school pupils and university students going on to study European languages or any languages for that matter at high school or university level. There's very limited support in terms of, you know, financial support for promoting European languages or other languages in the UK. The vast majority of people in the UK are monolingual, usually in English. There is a sizable proportion of the public who speak more than one language in the UK, and that's, you know, again, from my perspective as a linguist, that's fantastic. But certainly, we'd run the risk, I think, of further marginalizing the role of European languages in the UK and of other languages in the UK as well, kind of post-Brexit. And whether that will, you know, again, in 20, 30 years' time, will we be a nation of people who have no other languages? That's quite a scary thought, I think.
Could you speak a bit about the benefits of speaking another language that these English young pupils might be missing out on? Because I know that I've heard that there are some studies suggesting that people who are bilingual have sort of different brain connections and process information in a different way. Could you sort of give us a bit of an overview of what that entails?
Yes, I think we can look at the benefits in a couple of different ways. I think, as you mentioned there, the kind of cognitive benefits are really obvious. The rates of things like Alzheimer's seem to be reduced in bilingual or multilingual speakers compared to monolingual speakers. There's certainly more lateral thinking in bilingual and multilingual speakers than in
monolingual. What does that mean?
So being able to kind of think outside the box, being able to approach problems from different perspectives and see more than one solution, and particularly see kind of non-obvious solutions to a problem, those kinds of skills seem to be developed more in bilingual and multilingual speakers than they do in monolingual speakers. So there's an awful lot of evidence to suggest that in terms of having more than one language, cognitively you're in better health than a monolingual speaker. In terms of the kind of social benefits, for me, the biggest thing is that it gives you a perspective of, you know, a different perspective in the world. You get to learn about another culture, another society, another set of values from a completely different perspective than the one that you grew up with your mother tongue. That opens up a massive amount of opportunities for you in terms of employability opportunities. You know, if we're thinking about the way that the world is moving towards a kind of more globalized economy, being able to speak other languages opens up employment opportunities that you might not have necessarily had otherwise. Just in terms of kind of social enjoyment as well, being able to speak to people from other kinds of backgrounds, other cultures, learn about their background, their history, their experiences, and learn their stories as well. So for me, you know, having another language is a really important part of seeing the world in a different way. And I think that it's a real shame if school kids, you know, pupils and university students in the UK are maybe not given as many opportunities to achieve that following Brexit.
Thanks, Robert. And excuse me, just finally, it sounds that you're from north of the border. Whereabouts in Scotland?
I'm from just outside Glasgow, but I've been down in Birmingham now. I'll be 8 years in April, but I still have my Scottish accent, so I've not quite yet picked up a Brummie accent yet.
Yeah, very nice one it is too. I was just going to ask you if we have in the UK a few other languages ourselves, and Welsh speakers and Cornish speakers, and
yes,
like, I guess you're quite fond of those languages as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In Scotland, Gaelic, obviously, Welsh and Wales. There's an awful lot of revitalisation efforts going round about Cornish and Manx at the moment as well now. And I suppose one of the very sad things is that once a language dies out, once the last speaker of a language dies and takes that language with them, then that's a whole set of, you know, stories, myths, legends, and a whole world view that we lose, and that we're never going to be able to get back again. And so I think in terms of kind of language promotion, language revitalization, an awful lot could be done in the UK to promote Welsh, which does really, really well, to promote Gaelic, and to see these kind of more community-based languages, or more indigenous languages, sorry, like Cornish and Manx, be revitalised and reinvigorated. I think, you know, there's an awful lot of work being done on that right now, but it would be great to see more of that.
And just very, very finally, do any new languages spring up in 2017?
Well, do you watch Game of Thrones?
I don't, but I think gender matters.
I definitely do,
yeah. Yeah, so there's languages in Game of Thrones that have been invented, what are called constructed languages. And so there's a massive amount of work done on constructed languages, like Dothraki in Game of Thrones. Klingon was obviously another one in the Star Trek universe. You can't get the Star Trek, Star Wars thing mixed up. You'll get lots of very angry callers saying that Klingon's not in Star Wars, but in Star Trek.
Not yet.
Not yet, no. And then in the Superman, the most recent Superman, I think there was some constructed languages in that as well. So in terms of people actively creating new languages, then there's certainly a big market for that at the moment. And I think that's partly to do with creating a sense of authenticity and creating, again, as I said earlier on, a sense of a different culture, a different cultural perspective where people are using a different language and they have, you know, a different kind of culture, rather than them using English, say. They're using Dothraki or Klingon or whatever to represent something that's really quite different. So there is a lot of work being done on that, and that's a really exciting area of kind of growing research, I would say.
Robert, thanks ever so much for joining us today.
No worries at all. Thanks very much then.
As always, thanks for listening, and if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.